Well, I wouldn't let the little girl know, wouldn't let her know that she made me feel like a clown. There are a whole lot of girls looking for a good man like you. Oh, but you'll never meet him if you give up now and say your life's true. Then she said, oh, no, little strong survive.
To PMP with us right now, the legendary great singer Jerry Butler. You remember him from The Impressions and also the great song Only the Strong Survive and many others. He is now a county commissioner out in the Midwest, and he joins us right now on PMP. How are you?
Fine, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
This is an extremely interesting book.
Thank you.
Not only is it a musical book, but it kind of visits the racial history of our country as well.
Thanks so much. I was hoping that people would see it as more than just a discography.
Well, it certainly is more than that. And I know that your brother-in-law, Earl Smith, who wrote it with you, said that initially it was not meant to be what it turned out to be. But, I mean, that's the way the world was back then and to a certain extent still is.
Exactly. And as we started to write about the people that we had met and the places that we had been and the songs, and we thought that younger generations needed to know how the world was situated, especially America, at the time that those songs were being written. You notice we talk a little bit about World War II. We talk a little bit about the Vietnam conflict. And so all of those things really had an impact. There are people who come back from Vietnam and tell me that, you know, I had Only the Strong Survive with me in that foxhole over there. And the music of the Motown era, the Stax Watts era, and those kinds of songs are the things that held me together until I could get back home.
And songs like Edwin Starr's War, which...
Yeah, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
That pretty much told the story, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit about you growing up, and tell us a little bit about your childhood and where the music came from.
You know, this music, I think, is kind of in the culture. My mom and dad were sharecroppers in Mississippi and moved to Chicago 1942, which was kind of right in the middle of, right at the end of World War II. And at that time, there were about 2,000, I guess, a day of African-Americans migrating from the South into the industrial Midwest. And they brought with them this music. That we had a railroad that ran from New Orleans right into the heart of the loop almost in Chicago, which is called the Illinois Central Railroad. And all of that music coming up from New Orleans and from the Delta would stop right there at Roosevelt Road and Michigan Avenue. And the people would get off the train and they would head either south or west. And out of that came this whole musical culture that Chicago has, which is, and I say this with great pride, I think probably the greatest musical city in the United States.
I think that Detroit would argue about that. But.
Well, they probably could, but let's take a look at that. Detroit had one record company by the name of Motown that had any kind of renown. Chicago had VJ Records, which had Jimmy Reed and the Beatles and the Staple Singers and the big jazz catalogs. As a matter of fact, VJ was doing country and western in the early 60s when Motown was still struggling trying to get off the ground. Mm. There was Chess Records right across the street, which is where Muddy Waters and Ramsey Lewis and Ahmad Jamal and Etta James cut their teeth. And then downtown was Mercury Records with a whole slew of artists, the Andrews sisters, the McGuire sisters, the Dinah Washington, Quincy Jones was an A&R producer down there. And then there were little nightclubs and places here where all of these acts got together, and let's not even talk about gospel music, where you had Mahalia Jackson and Sam Cooke, and you know, I mean, you could just go on forever and ever. So certainly, Detroit had a claim, but I think Chicago's was far greater.
And the Chicago also had a group called The Impressions. Remember them? The Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Pretty good group as well.
Thank you. Thank you. And the unique thing about The Impressions were is that we spawned two lead singers, and all three acts went on to achieve some success on their own, which is kind of unique. You find usually when a vocalist leaves a group, as in the case of, say, Eddie Kendricks and, David Ruffin, leaving the Temptations, had some minor successes, but nothing of any great magnitude. On the other hand, Curtis, with The Impressions, had tremendous hit records with This All Right and Keep On Pushing, leaves The Impression and starts basically another career with the Superfly and the Claudines and the movie scores that he was writing.
Right.
And, I had some success on my own, and had it not been for the fact that Curtis was injured and passed away last December, I think the three of us, the three different groups, Curtis Mayfield, The Impressions, and myself, would have all been able to get together and do a tour, and each one of us stand on our own individually and then come to the stage collectively.
What a terrible tragedy that Curtis had, huh?
No question. It was just one of those things. And the beautiful thing about Curtis was he never complained, you know? Mm-hmm. And someone asked him one day, "Well, Curtis, do you ever think why you?" And he says, "I always think why not me?" You know, it could have happened to anybody.
He was your high school buddy. You guys, grew up together, right?
Actually, before high school. I met Curtis before he ever graduated from grammar school. He was about 9-10 years old when I met him, and I was 3 years older.
Hmm.
I met at his grandmother's church on the west side of this city, Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church.
Wow. We talked briefly about racial things in the country, and there's so many things we could talk about. I mean, I could talk 5 hours with you, but we can't do that, obviously, but... And I'm glad at this point in your life you're politically involved enough to be a county commissioner in Cook County. But talk a little bit about the whole thing with back in the 60s, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, all that kind of thing going on. And then I was just reading, I did not know this, but I was just reading that in 1961 at the Academy Awards, I remember Andy Williams singing Moon River. And I did not realize that was the song that you were on singing. You were supposed to sing that, but they didn't let you do it. They had him doing it. And he had a big hit out of it.
What happens, it was this. Andy Williams was recording for CBS Records, or Columbia Records,
right,
which owned CBS Broadcasting. And CBS Broadcasting was planning an Andy Williams show. I had recorded Moon River as the first vocal rendition of the song. Henry Mancini had the actual first recording of it because he did the motion picture score, and he did it with string and chorus. We recorded it later, and we changed the tempo, as a matter of fact, from three-quarter time to 4/4 time, and got into a little cha-cha rhythm, and we had this country guitar and the harmonica, and it worked so well that our record got played both on the pop stations and the rhythm and blues stations, and because of that, it went right up the charts real quick. About a year later, Andy Williams records an album entitled Breakfast at Tiffany's, and inside of this album was his version of Moon River. When the Academy Awards came around, he got nominated for having been the person to sing Moon River.
Yeah,
and
right,
because of his connection with CBS, mm-hmm, and the fact that they were trying to prepare him for the Andy Williams television show, they said, "What a wonderful vehicle. We could use him singing Moon River on the Academy Awards, and that gives us an immediate entree to the Andy Williams show." And as you know, Moon River became his theme song.
Right. But that whole thing, though, is just a great illustration of what was happening back in the late 50s and early 60s, where African-American artists were only played on African-American stations. There was no crossover, as they call it now.
Yeah.
And you had people like Elvis Presley singing African-American stuff.
That's very true. As a matter of fact, I was talking earlier today about Laverne Baker,
mm-hmm,
and Georgia Gibbs. Both had a song, Tweedledee-Dee-Dee-Dee-Dee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tweedledee-Dee was a big hit for Laverne, but it was only played on the rhythm and blues stations around the country. Georgia Gibbs, on the other hand, had the same record recorded pretty much the same fashion. As a matter of fact, you could play the two songs back to back and never change the padding of your foot because the tempo was that closely copied. Mm-hmm. And Laverne used to say, I wasn't so angry about her recording the song the way I recorded it. What I was angry about was that nobody ever heard my version.
Right.
And so it kept me in a secondary position on the charts because she was on a 50,000 watt station, I was on a 1,000 watt station.
Right.
Her record was being heard by 150 million people, mine was being heard by whoever happened to be able to pick up this little station at 1450 on the dial.
Right.
And so because of that, of course, record companies said, hey, we already know that Goodnight Sweetheart or Sincerely is a hit song. And it also implied that there really was no difference in the listener's ear as to what was a hit song and what wasn't a hit song. For instance, there was very rarely a record that was a hit in the black community that wouldn't be a hit in the white community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the only thing that separated it oftentimes was the fact that this was a black performer and this was a white performer, and the black performer was relegated to certain stations and even to the point that oftentimes could not have his records displayed in stores. I recall having a big argument with Jay Lasker, who was the president at Mercury for a while, and not Mercury, but at Motown for a while, but had started out as a promotion and marketing person with VJ Records, which was a black-owned company, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, when I asked him why he wouldn't put my picture on the cover of the album, he said, because I won't be able to get it in certain stores. You know,
well, I mean, look at the time you were touring, you couldn't even go to certain hotels. You would be performing in the ballroom or something, and you couldn't even stay there or use their facilities.
That's right? Absolutely true. As a matter of fact, Belafonte and Sammy Davis were working in Vegas and places like that, and they were really the artists who helped to break down the barriers of Vegas and Miami Beach by their performances. They said, well, you know, we can't perform here unless we can live here and unless our people are able to come and see the show. And in great measure, those two men were very much responsible for a lot of the barriers relative to hotel accommodations and performing in those major nightclubs coming down.
Mm. Well, now that we're in the 2000s, is there a lot of change from the 1960, 40 years ago?
Oh, enormous change. Enormous change. I was looking at the Queen Latifah show the other day, and I thought the only shows that you would see back in the 60s would have been Amos and Andy and Beulah.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
That there were no black performers who had their own television show. I think Nat King Cole had a show that lasted about 13 weeks but was blacked out in 13 states because he was black.
And you had Rochester on Jack Benny.
Exactly, exactly. But I'm talking, Rochester was part of the Jack Benny show.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about young black performers having their own shows, usually hour and a half in duration, and there's a multitude of them, not just a few, but a bunch.
Well, you can thank one person for that.
Okay.
Bill Cosby.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
And again, and the Wayans brothers within Living Color broke a lot of lines as well.
Yes. Yes, but you see, the lines were not as thick. They weren't as corded as greatly as they are now.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the Williams brothers came along, it had already become acceptable to have, you know, the Red Fox show had already been there, the Scully Mitchell show had been there, Flip Wilson had done the Geraldine thing, Cosby had done the thing with the Robert Culp. You know, so all of those things were the breaking down of the barriers.
Right, yeah. And now, of course, the rap thing has kind of overwhelmed music.
Well, you know, I think that has been a case of two things. One, technology, and the second part has been the economics. The economics of making rap music is so good that record companies have just bought into it hook, line, and sinker. Because in most instances, you have one or two players who are doing all of the work, making all of the music, scratching records and using samplings from other records, and so there are no musicians to be paid.
Mm.
And so the producer and the record company gets all the money.
Interesting. We should mention that you have a great book out. Of course, we all know the great song, Only the Strong Survive, which we heard as we entered this interview. And Only the Strong Survive is now a book called Memoirs of a Soul Survivor, Only the Strong Survive. And it's by the Indiana University Press and available right now in stores. And a fascinating, fascinating journal of many, many years out there where you touch on so many names. I want to just mention a few names, have you talk a little bit about them. I understand Nat King Cole was someone you saw when you were young and you just fell in love with his voice.
Absolutely. Not just his voice, his whole demeanor. The whole idea of Jerry Butler being known as the Iceman basically came because I wanted to emulate Nat King Cole. I thought his presentation, I mentioned in the book how on the night of my prom, I took a young lady and we went to see Nat King Cole at a club here in Chicago called the Chez Paris. And the man worked with a trio, a conga player, and when he walked on stage in that black tuxedo and his hair Marcel to the max, he was just everything that I thought a man should be. And the people left there, and that during those periods, it was unusual to see that many black faces in a audience in a club of that caliber. It was the Copacabana of Chicago. And the people were just overwhelmed at what a wonderful musician he was, what a wonderful singer he was. And I went home trying to emulate that and had no idea at the time that a few years later I would actually be in show business.
Wow. About the name Otis Redding.
My man. Otis Redding and I wrote a song called I've Been Loving You Too Long. We were doing a show in Buffalo, New York, at a place called the Kleindienst Auditorium. And afterwards, we went to the hotel and we sat around with a bottle of J&B and started talking, making jokes. And he said, Jerry, have you got any songs that you haven't been able to finish? Let's write some songs. And I showed him the first verse of I've Been Loving You Too Long, and he said, man, I love it. Let me have it, and I'll take it, and I'll go back to Memphis, and I'll work on it. The next time I heard it, it was on a record, and he was singing it. And he called me, and he said, it's a hit, Jerry. I'm telling you, it's a hit. I said, sure it is. You just released it, and you think it's a hit. He said, no, I'm telling you how the people are reacting to it, that this song is going to be a smash. And sure enough, it was a smash. And the ironic thing was that I didn't have a hit at the time, but I never could have recorded the song the way he recorded it. And when people ask me about it, I tell them that the song was a good idea, but the way Otis sang it is what made it the hit that it was.
He was an incredible talent. Another person who didn't live long enough.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here's another name for you, Sam Cooke.
Yes, he was probably the prototype of all the rhythm and blues gospel singers. Somebody once said that For Your Precious Love was the first soul recording, but I think Darling, You Send Me was really the first time that the feeling of the sacred was mixed with the secular. When Sam left singing gospel music with the Soul Stirrers and started a career on his own, that was really the thing that set in motion for singers who were coming out of the gospel tradition to really start making secular music. Mm-hmm. And he was just an awesome, awesome talent. I mean, not only did he have this wonderful, smooth, falsetto voice, but he could growl and grunt with the best of them. And I used to go as a kid to watch him singing with Soul Stirrers and how they would work up an audience without ever really breaking a sweat. It was just a marvelous thing to see.
Let me give you a couple non-musical names here. Rosa Parks.
Well, you know, that's the lady that refused to give up a seat. And out of refusing to give up a seat, started the whole civil rights movement as we know it now historically. She, just a sweet lady, quiet, unassuming, because, you know, history tells us that there have been several other people that had been arrested in Alabama for doing what she did. But nobody would take her case, or their case rather, because one girl was young and they said, well, if we try to move this whole movement around her, they will call her a floozy, they will say that she's an upstart, they will do this kind of stuff. But here was this little lady who was a seamstress, who was a member of the NAACP, who was a church-going woman, who was just a quiet spinster. And they said, we can't find no fault in her. And so this is the one that we're going to back. And that was how the whole thing got started.
And Martin Luther King.
Well, without question, one of the great spiritual leaders of our time. And when I say spiritual leaders, I'm not talking just from a religious point of view. I'm talking about the spirit of character, the spirit of being willing to put life and limb on the line for a cause, for an idea, for a belief. And then to have the ability as an orator to motivate people to follow him. I mean, to me, and I'm 60 years old now, I have never seen anything like that. And certainly Malcolm was a great speaker. Farrakhan's great speaker. Jesse Jackson, a great speaker. But none of them in the same league as Martin Luther King.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned Farrakhan and Jackson. What are your impressions of them?
Well, you know, Jesse and I have been friends from the first day he came to Chicago. As a matter of fact, he teases me oftentimes about how he was in school down in North Carolina the first time he heard me. They're only about 3 years difference in our age. I'm the older of the two. But Jesse, when the history is written about Jesse Jackson, folks will see that he has made a major contribution to the civil rights causes and to the labor causes in America. As a matter of fact, I was watching him this morning just before I left home. He's out there in California trying to help settle the dispute that the transportation workers and the city were having out there. And somebody once said to me, he said, well, you know, that Jesse Jackson is an arrogant so-and-so. And I said, well, you know, to do what he does takes a lot of moxie. To be a little guy that comes from North Carolina and become one of the most famous men in America just by sheer guts and willing to step out and put your life on the line for a cause takes a whole lot of moxie. Yeah. And so I give him credit for that.
Well, one of the things that Reverend Farrakhan and Reverend Jackson have both got in some trouble for was some of their remarks about Jewish folk.
Yes.
I'm wondering what your reaction is to that and the whole controversy that swirled around it.
My mother used to say, nothing ruins the duck but his bill. And by that she meant is that oftentimes men who have good intentions, who don't mean to be offensive, will wind up getting caught up in the spirit of a moment and saying something that they probably wish they later would not have said. It's misspeak or misspoken. And I don't think that in any of those instances where those things were said, they just got caught up in the moment and said something that they hadn't really considered all of the ramifications of it, and it's haunted them ever since.
I think Reverend Jackson in particular, with his Hymietown remark, was a pretty much a one-time thing. He hasn't really said much after that.
Right.
But Reverend Farrakhan continuously rails against the Jews as the devils and many other equivalents, and I think that he does turn off some of the population with these comments.
Oh, I'm sure, but I'm also of the opinion that over time he has tried to tone that down and to move away from it. And as a matter of fact, he was here in Chicago once with a whole cadre of religious leaders and apologized for making those kinds of statements. So, you know, it's not something that people will accept easily, but at least to have the compassion and the will to stand up and say, I was wrong, I apologize, is a pretty good thing to do.
Talking to Jerry Butler, the book is called Only the Strong Survive. I heard there's some rumors that you might actually run for mayor of Chicago. Is that true?
I don't think so. You know, the easiest thing to get started is a rumor. I think that our present mayor is doing a fine job. There are some people who disagree with his politics. But that would happen to any politician. That's part of the game. Whether or not I would ever run, I'm 60 years old, and to tell you the real truth, mayor of the city of Chicago is oftentimes a thankless job. It you know, this is where the buck stops. Every problem that comes to the city, the mayor is involved with it, and I don't know if I want to commit that kind of thing to the rest of my life.
How about Governor Jerry Butler?
Well, the governor thing is I don't believe is as difficult as the mayor, but the problem with it is that you've got to run through the whole state of Illinois.
Right.
And once you get outside of Chicago, you are in Republican territory.
I assume that you are you working for Vice President Gore, or do you have any?
Actually, I'm going to be supporting President Vice President Gore, but I'm really just trying to encourage everybody to get out and vote, and whoever wins will win. But it would be a disaster if we have a very low turnout at the polls, because I believe that no matter who winds up sitting in this chair, they will wind up sitting there not knowing that they have a mandate from the people to serve.
Well, I don't think there's been a president that's had a majority of the actual population vote for them for many, many years.
Not for a long time.
Yeah. A couple of emails came in while we're talking here, so let me ask you. One of them wants to know if you're going to be doing any touring, singing, that they can come see you.
Yes, I am. As a matter of fact, we are on the Internet. I am not an Internet kind of person, so I don't have a lot of this information that I could give so that folks can dial up and see where I'm going to be.
Do you have, like, a website? Do you have, is it jerrybutler.com? Or?
You don't see, that shows you how...
You have no idea, do you?
I'm not really into that. But I think there's something around here someplace. I can't find it now.
We'll see that. Well, we'll see what we can do. We'll try to do a link if we can find one for you.
All
do
right.
A little search of the web.
Very
and
good.
See what we can find. The other question that folks had is, do you have any new music coming out at all?
As a matter of fact, I am going down to Memphis the week of the 26th, to talk with a young man by the name of Norbert Putnam, who is starting a new label situation down there and is interested in my doing some recording for the company. I think initially we're going to re-record some of the older product, but I'm sure that if we're successful in that venture, that it will lead to having some new product recorded, and perhaps maybe next year we will have some new product out.
Well, for all the old product and the stuff to come, we want to say thanks to you, Jerry Butler. And the book is called Only the Strong Survive, Memoirs of a Soul Survivor. It's from Indiana University Press and available by bookstores everywhere, Amazon.com, or you can call 1-800-842-6796. Jerry, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Have a good one.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.